Chapter 13. A table sat in the middle of the room, stacked high with charts and books, and an orrery, a small model of the heliocentric universe with the various heavenly bodies fixed to brass arms. It was an impressive piece, the clockwork mechanism ticking as the small golden planets revolved around the larger sun. I had seen such an instrument only once before, in a private collection in Florence, where I had been shown the various intricacies, the way each hollow planet could be unscrewed and detached from the golden arms so that it might be packed away for travelling purposes. The continents and oceans of the Earth were identified with etched Latin names, so minute as to be visible only with the aid of the magnifying glass, attached by its own arm at the equator. The whole thing was fitted with a clockwork mechanism, so that the planets might revolve, each in its own time, with a tiny alabaster moon hovering gently about the Earth. It was meant to educate, but so lovely and intricate a device must be admired simply as a thing of beauty as well. Effie perched upon the table, an open book resting upon the back of the Italian greyhound curled up in her lap. It lifted its head when I entered, gave a great sniff with its pointed nose and settled again, clearly unimpressed. The walls had been fitted with enormous windows, and Anjali stood beside one, flapping her hand at the open casement, and the room's atmosphere was thick with a pungent and distinctive odour. "If you mean to disperse the smell of cigarette smoke, keep a dish of strong vinegar about," I advised. "It does wonders to clear the air." Anjali pressed her lips together, but Effie burst out laughing.
"Do you really not mind, then? You won't tell?"
I advanced into the room and closed the door carefully behind me. I extracted my own cigarette case and struck a vesta.
"I think not."
After that, we were entirely convivial. Anjali still demonstrated the caution I have often noticed in upper servants. Not entirely staff, and definitely not family, companions, like governesses, were neither fish nor fowl. They enjoyed too many privileges to permit intimacy with the rest of those employed in the household, but too few to allow them equality with their masters and mistresses. Yet she seemed genuinely fond of Effie, and I was glad the poor girl had at least one person in the house who seemed to support her interests in science. Not only support them, but share them. For Anjali was well-read, and we had a spirited conversation on the relative merits of Galvani versus Volta and Lamarckian versus Darwinian theory. She was passionately enthusiastic about Darwin and most appreciative of my recommendation of the work of Antoinette Brown Blackwell.
"I shall make a point of reading her efforts," she promised. "Although, so long as she is a critic of Lamarck, I have no doubt I will find her writings instructive."
"I am delighted to hear such reasonable views," I told her. "Mr. Templeton Vane is decidedly too fond of Lamarck for his own good." Just then, the mantel clock struck the hour, and Anjali smoothed out her skirts, resuming once more the sober mien of an upper servant. She inclined her head to Effie in what might have been interpreted as a bit of light mockery, for her lips twitched as she bobbed a curtsy.
"Miss Euphemia," she murmured.
She turned in my direction.
"Miss Speedwell."
She left us then, and a peaceful silence settled over the observatory. From this vantage point, one might watch sheep and clouds, both formless masses of white, gathering and shifting over the moor. The clock ticked on, and there was a muted, wet snuffle from the dog. "It is nice that you have a companion," I told her, gesturing towards the dog. As if sensing she was under discussion, the pup lifted her head and gave me a lofty look.
"A gift from my godfather, Sir Hugo Montgomery," she said with a tinge of pride. "But you must know him. He corresponded with Charles to arrange the sale of the collection to Lord Rosmoren.
I have made his acquaintance, I temporized.
I do not see him very often, she said. He sends me £5 on my birthday every year, and he brought Al Ijlia as a present the last time he visited. But he and Charles quarrelled, so I do not think he will come again soon.
Al Ijlia, you have given her an Arabic name. The dog put her nose forward tentatively, and I ventured to hold out my hand for her to smell.
I called her after Al Ijlia bint Al Ijli, an astronomer who lived in Aleppo before the Crusades. Can you imagine? She asked, her eyes shining. She was making scientific instruments 1,000 years ago.
A worthy namesake, I agreed.
She rolled her eyes. Mary doesn't like it. She refers to her as Jilly, and now everyone else does. Only Anjali calls her by her correct name.
She seems a good friend, I began.
Effie let out a sharp bark of laughter that startled the dog. Did Mary ask you to speak to me?
How did you know?
Because she does it with anyone she thinks might be able to persuade me to listen.
She pitched her voice into an exact impression of her sister-in-law's affected tones.
Effie, you mustn't consort with the help. It simply is not done, and it sets such a bad example for the children.
She rolled her eyes again.
As if I care about setting an example for the children.
You are not fond of your nephew and nieces?
I loathe the little horrors, she said frankly. The twins are babies, and therefore unspeakably dull. Little Ada just stares with a sort of terrifying intensity as if she is trying to see underneath my skin. And the less said of Geoffrey and his obsession with putting things in cages, the better.
I have never been inclined to like children myself, I admitted. I am far more content with butterflies and dogs. Al Ijlia nosed closer to me, shoving her snout under my hand until Effie laughed.
She wants you to scratch behind her ears. She is a peremptory little beast, but I am fond of her.
I obediently scratched behind the dog's ears, earning myself a delicate little lick when I was finished. I looked about, surveying the stacks of notebooks and instruments arranged on a series of low shelves so as not to impede the view from the vast windows. A telescope, ancient-looking with a wide, cracked lens, stood in front of one of the windows. The expansive vistas made the small room seem quite spacious, and I was conscious, for the first time since arriving at the hall, of a sort of quiet peace. I like it here, I told Effie. I see why you have made this your bolt hole.
When it is clear, you can see almost to Torquay, and at night, the stars are as numerous as grains of sand upon the shore.
My gaze fell upon the orrery, the planets still making their revolutions around the sun. Some of them almost imperceptibly slow.
It was Granfer's, and it was meant to be mine.
Her complexion flushed, an unbecoming colour on one with gingerish hair. I am sorry, I told her truthfully. Perhaps it need not go, I began.
Charles insists. The telescope is worthless now, she said, with a nod towards the cracked instrument. But the orrery is in excellent condition, and rather rare, Italian in origin, worth a considerable amount of money, so naturally Mary and Charles are interested in it. I have made my peace with it,
she added quickly, and I wondered whether to believe her. She went on.
Besides, I have Granfer's research notebooks, and they are more valuable, at least to me. I am continuing his work.
She paused and made a vague gesture towards the notebook in her lap. What is the work? I inquired. Her eyes narrowed suspiciously.
Do you really want to know? People ask, but they never listen when I tell them.
I can believe that, One only has to watch someone's eyes glaze over as you try to explain the distinctions between lepidopterans to know that such queries are seldom sincere. Mine is, I assure you. Tell me. She resettled her spectacles on her nose.
Very well. Granfer was fascinated by the work of Lockyer and Janssen in discovering an element they detected in the emission line of the sun's atmosphere. They called it helium.
After Helios, the sun god? I asked.
Exactly,
Effie said. Her face was suffused with enthusiasm, eyes agleam as she spoke. She explained that while her grandfather was content to search for traces of helium on Earth, she was more intrigued by the fact that it had been discovered during an eclipse.
With the developments in scientific instruments, the observations that could be made during eclipses would be orders of magnitude greater than anything that has been possible before. We might further our understanding of how fast the stars are moving, what comprises them, and if it would ever be possible to reach them.
Her dream of humankind sailing amongst the stars seemed far-fetched at best, but I was in a mood to humour the girl. Too many people had been content to shatter her illusions. I would not be one of them. And what would it take for you to continue your research?
Well, it would help a very good deal if Charles were not selling my equipment out from under me,
she replied tartly.
But if I am honest, there are more advanced instruments with which I could do more. I have clung to Granfer's orrery because it is of sound quality, and it is so beautiful. Its very antiquity is what makes it valuable to Charles. But a proper observatory with the latest, most sensitive telescope would enable me to do so much more.
A rueful smile touched her lips.
There is no point in wishing. Such a laboratory is quite beyond my means.
Yes, I understand a proper telescope alone is costly, I mused. I belong to a club for extraordinary women. Philosophers, botanists, mathematicians, that sort of thing. We have a pair of astronomers amongst our members, and only last year we were able to finally provide funds to establish them in an observatory of their own. It took a good deal of effort, but we secured enough contributions to purchase a tiny ruined castle on the shores of Loch Doon. Apparently the night sky there is quite unsmirched by the fogs and smogs of the cities.
Are you speaking of the Marvell sisters?
She asked, her eyes rounding.
Oh, do you know them? Know them? They are legend,
she breathed.
And you have met them?
Once or twice in the course of raising the funds necessary to establish them in Scotland. The Marvells, Henrietta and Lucy, were somewhere beyond 40, vague, wispy-looking women with flyaway hair, and the habit of trailing off in the middle of sentences as though they had lost the thread of their thoughts. Privately, we joked that it was the result of spending too much time lost amongst the stars, but we jested only with the deepest affection. I went on. I am afraid we shall see nothing of them now they have their Scottish eyrie. They send monthly reports to the club and seem thoroughly content.
I am not surprised, she said, her small hands curling into fists. They have managed to make a life for themselves doing what they love, as you have.
I smiled at her. It was rather easier for me. Lepidopterists require only a butterfly net and a good deal of perseverance, along with considerable luck.
Sometimes, she said,
her eyes quite blank behind the smudged spectacles,
you have to make your own luck.
Chapter 14. I made my way to the long gallery to speak with Stoker. The time had come, I told myself firmly, and I must seize the moment, grasp the nettle, take the bull by the horns. I had exhausted my catalogue of metaphors, so I paused on the threshold, steeling myself. There were few moments in my life that had ever required such courage, I reflected. I had been shipwrecked, menaced by villains, abducted, more than once, in fact. In short, I had been in peril so many times I could scarce count them. And yet, nothing frightened me so badly as the notion of revealing to Stoker what I had taken such pains to conceal. "This will not do," I said aloud, summoning all my resolve. I put my hand to the knob and turned it, striding into the room as I began to speak. "Stoker, I must—"
"Veronica,"
he called, in a tone I had seldom heard him employ outside of intimate congress. He was, in a word, enraptured. His eyes shone, his colour was high, even his hair seemed to wave more exuberantly. He was standing on the far side of the room, his attention fixed upon something I could not see.
"Come and see,"
he urged.
"It is magnificent."
I went to him and saw that he had found it at last. "The thylacine," I exclaimed. He must have only just uncovered it, for the dust sheet had been thrown back, motes still dancing in the light of the lamps.
"Thylacinus cynocephalus,"
he breathed.
"At last."
It was rather smaller than one might have expected for the ferocity of its reputation, scarcely larger than a medium-sized dog, but its expression belied any domestication. The snout was pointed, and the lips curled back to reveal a set of teeth clearly meant for ripping. The ears were small and neat and slightly rounded, the jaw heavy. Stripes, subtle near the head, became more pronounced as they proceeded to the back, ending in a long, whippet-thin tail.
"I quite understand what you mean about the jaw,"
said a familiar voice. I realized then that we were not alone. I had been sufficiently distracted by Stoker's discovery to have overlooked his companion. Harry, in his guise as Jonathan Hathaway, was standing in the shadows behind Stoker, peering around him to look at the creature.
"Is it not a glorious sight, Hathaway?"
Stoker asked, his voice as contented as a cat's. Hathaway. He did not correct Stoker, but then I had not anticipated that he would. He was smiling at me, but I caught the pleading expression in his eyes and turned away. "A most impressive creature," I told Stoker. "Is it male or female?"
"Male,"
Stoker pronounced.
"But unlike other antipodean marsupials, the male has a pouch into which it can withdraw the scrotal sac for defensive purposes during an attack. It is an extraordinary specimen. It ought to have been mounted to display the full range of its bite."
80 degrees,
Jonathan put in.
"Is that not what you said?"
"More or less,"
Stoker agreed.
"You can see here."
He was off again, pointing out the intricacies of the animal's anatomy, from its remarkable jaw to the jaunty angle of its tail. "I will leave you to it," I said quietly. They both made the appropriate noises, but they scarcely seemed to notice when I withdrew to the far side of the room in order to examine the cases of lepidoptery specimens. Those I had already found were old, from Sir Geoffrey's time, and, due to the deleterious effects of shipping and improper handling, had noticeably deteriorated in quality. But as I moved on, I received a shock, for the next case was much newer, and I recognised the hand that had inscribed the labels. "Ornithoptera euphorian," I read, tracing the neat penmanship. I remembered Jonathan Hathaway labouring over this particular case, mounting the pretty set of Cairns bird wings he had netted in Australia. It had been raining in Sumatra, and butterfly hunters do not give chase in the rain. We had settled in for a long afternoon of writing up our journals and labelling our collections, exchanging stories and admiring each other's handiwork. I had been assembling a particularly lucrative collection of Saturniidae for a gentleman in Scotland with a passion for moths, and had just secured the largest exemplar of Atticus Atlas I had ever seen. 9.5 inches across, it was enormous and almost wildly beautiful with its rusty colorations and geometric patterns. Jonathan had insisted upon toasting my success, while Harry had speculated on the amount of the bonus I could expect for capturing such a beauty. Jonathan had finished his case of bird wings that day and shipped it home to Hathaway Hall, but I had carefully stowed my atlas with the rest of the moths. Within 6 weeks, they would be destroyed in the eruption, and I never did see the payment for the days I had spent roaming the jungles of Sumatra. But what I remembered most of that day was the genuine pleasure Jonathan Hathaway evinced at my success. I glanced up to find Harry standing behind me.
"I recall that day,"
he said softly.
"It was the day I decided to ask you to marry me."
"Don't," I ordered, "or I will tell him this instant."
"You were never more beautiful than when you were on the hunt,"
he went on. I rose, but his hand came around my wrist.
"Can you bear to destroy his happiness?"
he asked, flicking a glance to where Stoker stood, working on the thylacine. He was taking notes, calipers and magnifying glass at hand, singing The Maid of Amsterdam, with a few particularly explicit additions he had doubtless learned in the Navy. He looked utterly content, and I wrenched my wrist free from Harry's grip.
"Do not test me," I hissed.
But even as I left the room, I realized how easily Harry had discovered my Achilles heel and how true had been his aim. After dinner that evening, more delicious food and bland conversation, we gathered again for coffee around the hearth. This time Effie joined us for dinner, and Anjali had even been permitted to appear when coffee was served. After the first cups had been drunk, Lady Hathaway snapped her fingers at Anjali.
"Go with Effie. She knows what I want."
Anjali bowed her head and followed Effie from the room.
"What are you on about, Granna?"
Charles asked affectionately. Lady Hathaway gave him a slow smile as she folded her hands over the top of her walking stick.
"Just you wait, boy. I do love a surprise." "At your age," Mary said, with more candour than tact.
Lady Hathaway's mouth thinned.
"When you have reached my advanced years, Mary dear, I do hope you will have acquired a little wisdom to compensate for the loss of your good looks."
Jonathan's lips twitched with a suppressed smile, but Mary seemed not to notice how thoroughly she had been put in her place. There was a complacency to her, the self-satisfaction of the young, I thought. She knew well enough that in a short while she would be undisputed mistress of Hathaway Hall. Her things would be moved into the master suite, no doubt after she had redecorated, stripping away every last reminder of Lady Hathaway. By virtue of her age alone, she would triumph. Viewed in that light, it was rather sordid and a little sad, I decided. Lady Hathaway had clearly been a person of some influence, accustomed to wielding power over those around her. With the passage of time, she had become smaller, until all that remained were the tiny tyrannies of the elderly inflicted upon the young. It all made me exceedingly grateful that I had no proper family to speak of. I enjoyed the smug solitude of an orphan, with no obligations to trouble me and no expectations to stifle my whims. It might be lonely at times, if I were entirely honest, but how much better to be alone with my dignity intact than at the mercy of my relations?
It was only a few short minutes until Effie and Anjali returned bearing a small casket. I was not familiar enough to distinguish among the various styles of Indian workmanship, but the artistry was clearly from that part of the world. It was wrought silver, badly tarnished but still lovely. Effie presented it to her grandmother with a flourish, while Anjali handed over a key, an enormous thing with a thick silken tassel attached to one end.
Grana?
Charles Hathaway began, half rising from his seat.
Is that?
She waved him back to his chair.
It is indeed, Charles. Do not fuss.
She settled the casket on her lap and fitted the key to the lock. It turned with an audible protest, and Effie had to help. But at last there came a decisive click, and the lid sprang free. Lady Hathaway beamed down at the contents, an expression of fondness warming her features.
There you are, my darlings, she crooned. It has been a long time.
She reached a hand into the casket and brought it up again, dripping in rubies. We gasped as they caught the light, flinging it back again, the glittering scarlet sparks warming the pale, withered flesh of her hand. She gave a delighted laugh and dipped her hand again, this time emerging with a string of emeralds. Pearls followed, long strands of them looping about her arm. She presented earrings and brooches and bracelets, all set with the same gems, and a turban ornament in the shape of a peacock's tail, paved with rubies.
Do you see that little hollow?
She asked us, demonstrating the empty chamber at the top of the turban ornament.
That is where a plume would go, always an ostrich feather of purest white. And here,
she added, touching a spot just above the elaborate scarlet tail,
this is where the heart of the peacock belongs.
She reached a last time into the casket and drew out a velvet box. She handed it to Jonathan.
Open it, lad, she ordered.
He gave her a questioning look, but she flapped her jewel-laden hands at him.
Do as I say.
He looked at the group. My own expression must have been one of wide-eyed wonder, for I had never seen such an assemblage of jewels, and I had once worn the crown jewels of the Alpenwald. The others looked frankly astonished at the magnificent display heaped in her ladyship's lap. Jonathan took a deep breath and opened the box. He caught his breath, and I knew he was not pretending. His awe was entirely sincere. With reverent fingers he drew out a stone, an enormous thing, as red as blood and shimmering with the crimson glow of a still-beating heart.
The Eye of the Dawn,
Lady Hathaway said, as he held the gem up to the light.
Perfect pigeon's blood colour and without flaw. It was mined in the mountains of Persia and has a fascinating history. It was given by the Shah of Persia to a Maharaja as a peace offering after years of violence between them. It is said that the stone was originally a diamond, but turned to a ruby from the blood shed between these two warlords. The Maharaja had it set into the turban ornament to display it proudly, but he wore it for only a month before he died. His son and successor wore it less than a year. After that, it was believed cursed for men to wear it, and it was removed from the turban ornament and placed into a necklace instead for the Maharani. Eventually, it passed into the hands of a particular Maharani whose husband was instrumental in the Sepoy Mutiny. During the confusion of the rebellion, the jewels came into my husband's possession.
He presented them to me, of course, and they have been mine ever since.
Stoker and I exchanged glances. Her ladyship had not been forthcoming on how the jewels came into her husband's possession, but it was presumably not through legitimate means. Colonials had used the mutiny as an excuse to seize property owned by the native royals, and more than one upstanding English family had found itself the richer for it, albeit no one ever admitted publicly to behaving like privateers. If priceless gems and expensive bric-a-brac suddenly found their way from palace strongrooms to the necks and drawing rooms of the British in India, who would complain? Certainly not the various nobles whose possessions had been plundered. The collapse of the mutiny had left many of them in the precarious position of having openly supported the overthrow of the authorities who were firmly entrenched in India. A few ropes of pearls or blooded horses were a small price to pay to avoid serious repercussions for having been on the losing side of the rebellion. Whether Sir Geoffrey Hathaway had stolen the gems outright, or exerted pressure upon the prince to hand them over, they had certainly not been given freely, I surmised.
Magnificent, Effie breathed.
It is,
Jonathan Hathaway said in a low, reverent voice.
It will be yours, lad,
Lady Hathaway told him.
I have sent instructions to my solicitor, and the necessary codicil has been signed.
Jonathan opened his mouth, but Lady Hathaway held up a hand.
Do not fuss. I mean to keep them until I am dead, for I do like to look at them now and again. But when I die, they are yours.
Mary gave her husband a sharp look, and he interjected.
But, Grana, surely you recall that the jewels were being fetched from the bank so that Mary might wear them for her portrait?
He began. Lady Hathaway curled a lip.
The jewels are my own private property, Charles, and it is not your concern what I do with my property.
Lady Hathaway said firmly.
Of course,
he replied, holding up a hand.
Certainly. Right you are.
Mary said nothing, but her lips were clamped tightly together. She rose and smoothed her skirts.
If you will excuse me, I must look in on the children.
Charles looked after her as she left, clearly unhappy at being caught between his wife and his grandmother. He fell to fiddling with his pipe, turning out the ashes onto the hearth and tamping in a fresh plug of tobacco.
Well?
Lady Hathaway prodded Jonathan.
What do you think?
Jonathan replaced the stone gently, almost reverently. He closed the box slowly, as if loath to take a final look at the ruby. He handed the box back to Lady Hathaway.
A most extraordinary stone,
he said in a soft voice. She nodded towards the casket.
All of this will be yours. Consider it amends for the loss of your birthright.
Jonathan covered her hand with his.
You are too generous. Perhaps we should discuss this later.
Charles looked up from where he had finally got his pipe to light.
Do not wait on my account. One of the ram lambs has wandered off, and I meant to see if he'd returned.
He rose and shambled out, looking more than ever like a forlorn sheepdog. Jonathan's gaze followed him.
I think your gift will bring trouble in its wake,
he told Lady Hathaway. She gave him a sharp glance.
What do I care? I shan't be here to see it. I shall be dead and mouldering.
she added with a smile.
Well, I certainly won't fuss, Effie put in. The jewels are most likely still cursed, and I've no intention of bringing that sort of thing down on my head.
And you call yourself a woman of science?
Her grandmother jeered. Effie coloured slightly.
I am a woman of science, although precious little good it does me in this family.
Her grandmother wagged a finger, sharp colour rushing into her mottled cheeks.
Do not take that tone with me, Euphemia. I will not stand for it. Do you hear me?
She seemed a fair way to working herself up, but Anjali stepped forwards.
It grows late, your ladyship, she said quietly. Would you care for hot milk tonight, or a tisane?
Hot milk,
the old woman said irritably.
Mind you sweeten it properly, and none of your foreign spices.
I felt a rush of sympathy for Anjali, trapped as she was in employment with such a disagreeable old person. But she merely inclined her head serenely.
Of course.
Lady Hathaway thrust the casket at Effie.
Carry this up to my room so I can lock it away properly. Anjali, give me your arm.
She struggled to her feet, making use of her walking stick as she rose. Anjali dipped her knees a little to better support her ladyship. They bade the rest of us good night and left. As the door closed behind them, Jonathan let out a long sigh. He seemed lost in thought, his attention fixed upon the fire. The light of the flames played over his face, shadows chasing one another as they flickered. I steeled myself. The time had come. I rose and looked at Stoker, opened my mouth to ask him to accompany me to my room, where I would tell him everything.
I say, this has all been a bit much. Would you mind playing a game or two of billiards? A little distraction would not go amiss,
Jonathan said to Stoker.
Certainly,
Stoker said. His innate courtesy would require him to oblige. Besides which, he adored billiards and was always complaining he could never get a satisfactory game since I am, in his words, entirely lethal with a stick and not to be trusted anywhere near a billiards table. It is the rankest lie. I have only broken 2 windows in the course of playing with him, and they were not particularly valuable ones at that. I was hoping to speak with you, I said, turning to Stoker. He paused by my chair and pressed a kiss to my hair.
I will look in on my way to bed,
he promised. Behind his back, Jonathan gave me a long, level look and shrugged by way of apology. As I suspected, he had known exactly what I intended and had cleverly managed to put off my confession for at least a few more hours. Feathers, I muttered as they left me. I sat for a long while, watching the flames die to embers, the room growing cold around me. At last, the falling temperature drove me to my room, where the fire had been kindled and a hot brick placed in my sheets. The warmth tempted me, but I was determined to stay awake until I had a chance to speak with Stoker. The weight of my secrets pressed upon me, and I was eager to be free of them, no matter the consequences. Chapter 15. In spite of my resolve, I must have drifted into the arms of Morpheus, for when I opened my eyes, a bleak grey daylight shone at the window. I was cramped, excruciatingly so, for having spent the night curled in the window seat, and it took several minutes to untangle myself and bring movement to my stiffened limbs. As I stretched my neck, I caught sight of a piece of paper that had been thrust under my door. It was half a sheet of foolscap, and I knew the hand well, even in a hasty scrawl. It was from Stoker,
A few words to explain that he and Jonathan had stayed at billiards until an unconscionably late hour, and though he had tapped, I had made no answer. He explained that he was in need of specialist packing materials for the purposes of protecting the thylacine, and as none was to be had nearer than Exeter, he had taken the earliest train and would return after luncheon. I tossed the letter aside with a few choice words that would have scandalized the rest of the household had they heard me. Now that I had made up my mind to confess all to Stoker, every hour the action was delayed had become torture. I felt suffocated by the burden of the truth, and even the air in the hall seemed thick with my deceit. I could bear it no longer. Without Stoker at hand, I realized there was slim purpose to my working in the long gallery alone. There was little work to be done with the butterfly collections, and I could easily manage it whilst Stoker was occupied with his beloved thylacine. The rest of the Hathaways would doubtless be engaged in their regular activities, and I had no wish to join them. I was, in a word, free. With alacrity, I donned my working costume of tweed trousers and shirtwaist, buttoning over this a fitted waistcoat and a jacket. A narrow skirt, which could be buttoned up and out of the way if necessity demanded, concealed the immodesty of the trousers, while flat boots buttoned to the knee protected my legs. I took up my equipment: net, killing jars, cotton wool pads soaked in a cyanide solution, and a small wicker hamper like a fisherman's creel. A packet of minuten, the tiny headless pins of the lepidopterist's trade, were neatly fitted into my cuffs, and for good measure I slipped my favourite knife into my boot. I wore no hat, content to feel upon my face whatever sunlight might oblige. I stopped in the kitchens long enough to ask Mrs. Desmond's cook for supplies for my little hamper. She complied with generous wedges of cheese and fruitcake, apples, a bottle of cold tea, and sausage rolls. I waved her a cheerful farewell and burst from the door with the same sense of escape as a prisoner released from his confinement. In a bound, I was through the summer house and on to the moor. It was early in the season yet, but I knew the watery meadows which lined the bogs were home to the pretty jewelled specimens of Dartmoor, fritillaries of every variety, hawk moths, hoverflies, hairstreaks, skippers, and even a few of my beloved swallowtails. They were domestic butterflies, much smaller and less brilliant than those of the tropics, but they were among the varieties I had chased first with my child's net. It kindled a keen sense of nostalgia to be in pursuit of them once more, scrambling over rocks and through puddles, after the flash of a soft blue or gentle purple wing. I had thought once that I had lost my taste for netting specimens, content to rear them by hand in my vivarium. But as I ran and climbed, intent upon the chase, my blood rose, and I felt a rush of familiar exultation. At noonday, I took my rest amidst a few standing stones atop an escarpment. The climb had been demanding, leaving me breathless with both exertion and delight as the countryside fell away before me. I could spot the various moorland folk about their business, shepherds moving amidst their flocks, peat cutters working the bogs for the slabs of peat used for the cottage fires. I perched above them all, sitting atop a standing stone that had conveniently toppled over, providing me with both seat and table for my picnic luncheon. The sausage rolls were squashed but delicious, the cheese flavoursome, the cake richly studded with fruits and spices. There was nothing like physical activity to heighten the pleasures of food, I reflected, dusting the crumbs from my fingers and draining the last of my tea. I had just tucked the bottle back into my hamper when I spotted a familiar figure upon the moor, walking with careless grace, his hands thrust deeply into his pockets as if he hadn't a concern in the world. A rush of emotion flooded me, and I snatched up my things to intercept him, flying down the little escarpment on winged feet. So rapid was my pace and so stealthy my steps that he was taken by surprise.
"Veronica!"
he exclaimed, obviously startled. He smiled, but I could tell from the quick dart of his eyes to the side that he was evaluating his odds of escaping. "If you think we are not going to have this conversation, you are entirely mistaken," I informed him. "You lied to me, Harry."
"Veronica, that is a dreadful thing to say."
"Your expression of wounded astonishment is most convincing. Tell me, do you practice it in the mirror for just such an occasion?" I asked. He clucked his tongue.
"It is a sad thing when a woman turns to cynicism. It's very aging, you know."
I started forwards, but he raised a hand.
"Peace, I beg you. Let us not quarrel, wife."
"Do not call me that," I spat, "and do not change the subject."
"What we were speaking of?"
he asked, furrowing his brow. "Your mendacity. You lied when you said that you merely wanted to remain at the Hall to enjoy the company of Lady Hathaway and give succour to her in her old age."
"Not at all, and I am frankly offended you should think so."
"The jewels," I hissed. "You knew about the jewels." He winced.
"I did not know."
"But you suspected."
"Well, I did surmise,"
he admitted.
"Jonathan told me there were some extremely valuable things lying around, and I thought if the old dear wanted to make me a present of them, I would certainly not offend her by refusing."
"Aha!" he sighed.
"You needn't look so triumphant. We both know my character, Veronica. I acknowledge my flaws. I am an opportunist. I am feckless and a bit of a coward at times."
I began to tick items off on my fingers. "You lie, you gamble, you cheat, you steal."
"I most certainly do not,"
he returned indignantly.
"Is it my fault that I am so personable that ladies often want to make me presents? Sometimes quite lavish ones?"
My mouth went slack. "Is that what you do? Persuade ladies to part with their fortunes?"
"Well, I am not proud of it, but a fellow has to make a living, and I was blessed with two assets, a passably handsome face and an exquisitely persuasive tongue. Now that I think on it, there is a third asset that has proven most useful."
I held up a hand. "I have experience of that particular asset, and the less said, the better. The point is, you explicitly said that your purpose in staying here was to rest and to find a way to get onto your feet in a legitimate way."
"And that is still my intention," he said firmly. "But I did not know specifically about the jewels until the sweet old dear opened the box last night and dropped them into my lap."
"I do not believe you," I told him. He shrugged.
"There is nothing I can do about that. I am, in spite of your convictions to the contrary, telling the truth. I knew there were a few choice items in the Hathaway collections, but I thought perhaps a nice dagger set with gemstones, or a few antique rugs, maybe a statue I could flog. I had no idea whatsoever that her ladyship was nesting comfortably upon such a clutch of golden eggs. And they are her golden eggs," he added firmly. "She owns them free and clear. What she does with them is entirely her business."
"Meaning that if she wishes to give them to you, she may do so?"
"Meaning exactly that. I did not expect such a stroke of luck. But believe me, I will not take kindly to any attempts to block it," he said,
the pleasant smile still touching his lips. "Do you mean to threaten me?" I was incredulous. "Harry, you forget that all I need do is drop a word into Lady Hathaway's ear, or Charles's, and your time here is finished.
Which you will not do,
he said, moving a step closer.
I had a lovely chat with your innamorato last night,
he told me, as the smile fell away.
We were rather far into our cups and got to know one another. It is astonishing what a few stray remarks can reveal.
My breath sat heavily in my chest. Stoker and I had so many skeletons lurking in our cupboards, they rattled like Spanish castanets. I could only hope that one secret in particular was still my own. What do you mean? I asked. I raised my chin in a gesture of bravado, but I did not think he found it convincing.
Charles Hathaway's library is an interesting place. He never uses it, you know. He prefers the estate office for conducting his business. That means no one is ever in the library, and it sits there, a dusty repository of all kinds of interesting information, the sort one finds in old newspapers and books like Debrett's.
I forced myself to breathe calmly as he went on.
It took only a few hours of poking about this morning to discover that your Mr. Templeton Vane has been married. A very nasty divorce, that,
he said, in a tone of speculation.
I imagine it has left him rather shy of the notoriety that comes with the attention of the press.
Gutter snipes, I said stoutly.
Yes, but useful, nonetheless,
he replied.
I imagine there are a few who might be interested in knowing that the infamous younger brother of the Viscount Templeton Vane is living in mortal sin with a woman who is not his wife, who is, in fact, married to another man.
But we are not. I bit off the words before I could finish the thought. His brows shot up.
You are not living in mortal sin? Only by the thinnest of technical margins, my dear. You have not committed bigamy, and for that I congratulate you. But I would like to point out that what you are doing is presumably worse, at least for Templeton Vane. He is consorting with a woman to whom he is not married, a woman with a husband. It paints the fellow in a very bad light indeed, I should think. I can only imagine what the newspapers would make of that.
I thought of JJ, my opportunistic friend, who had, at least thus far, resisted spilling my secrets to the world. But how much greater a story it would be if it were revealed that the semi-legitimate daughter of the Prince of Wales not only existed, but had a husband, and was comfortably sharing her favours with another man. Perhaps even personal loyalty would not be enough to still JJ's pen. And I would not be the only one destroyed by the lurid headlines. Stoker had experienced the viciousness of the popular press, and it had nearly killed him. I would not permit the hounds to tear at him again. My hands curled into fists. You would not dare, you... The exact word I used has no bearing on this narrative, but it was enough to cause Harry to adopt once more a wounded expression.
That was entirely uncalled for,
he protested. You are blackmailing me, I countered. I think it entirely justified.
I am not blackmailing you. I would never do such a thing.
He seemed genuinely affronted.
Blackmail would require that I demand money or services in exchange for keeping your secret. In point of fact, I am asking you to keep mine.
I opened my mouth and snapped it closed again. In that completely unnerving way he had, Harry had neatly turned the tables upon me. I had forgot, I said slowly.
Forgot what?
That talking to you is like staring into a carnival looking glass. Up is down, down is up. Nothing makes sense.
Of course it does,
His voice was gentle, and his smile back in evidence.
Veronica, do you think I enjoy playing the villain? I loathe it. I want only to be left alone. But, like any creature, I will fight if I am cornered. I know you do not trust me, but I wish, how I wish, that you would. I have endured so much these past years. I long for peace. And you know, as well as anyone, peace can only be purchased at a price. I am destitute. Would you see me beg in the streets? Of course not, I murmured. Then let me have this chance, he pressed. I vow to you, on anything you hold sacred, that I will not take so much as a crust of bread that has not been given freely to me.
And Lady Hathaway's jewels? I asked, curling a lip.
That is a question for another day, he said smoothly. She may change her mind. Charles and Mary may persuade her to keep them with the estate for the benefit of their children. Effie might coax her into giving them up as a dowry. Or the old dear might pawn them to take a holiday on the Riviera with Mrs. Desmond, he added, his smile deepening to reveal the dimple at the side of his mouth. For now, all I ask is that you do not interfere with me.
And in exchange, you will not interfere with me? I asked. You will not speak to the newspapers? He reached out to take my wrist. His fingers wrapped around my cuff, and he drew back with a sharp exclamation of pain as the minuten pierced his skin. Tiny drops of blood beaded his fingers.
Some things never change, he said,
with a rueful look at the prick marks on his hand. I am never entirely without defences, Harry. You should remember that. I stalked away from him, anger lending speed to my steps and distracting me from my footing. I walked for some time, over rises and down hillocks, until at last I had run out my rage. I set my foot down, expecting to find solid ground beneath me, but the earth itself seemed to shift. I had stepped into a puddle of mud, I realized, and made to withdraw my foot. Instead, it stuck fast, with all the tenacity of a hand gripped about my ankle. Blast and damnation, I muttered, dropping my net to the firm path and bending over to plant my hands in such a manner as to gain purchase to pull my foot free. But I had underestimated the strength of the suction of this little patch of bog. It crept up my nether limb, seizing foot, ankle, then shin in its embrace. The weight of the mud dragged at me, slowly, inexorably. I reached out for my net and drove it hard into the nearest bit of firm ground. Taking it in a firm grip, I pulled with all of my might, pushing down with my free foot in order to break the seal of the bog. With a violent crack, the pole of the net snapped in my hands, sending me flying backwards as my free foot slid out from under me. I caught myself at the last second, wrapping my hands in a tuft of moorgrass to prevent my body from being sucked entirely into the mire. My leg was now imprisoned up to the top of the thigh, and my free leg was inching perilously close to it. Something in the grasses I held gave way then, and I slid backwards, my second leg now firmly in the grip of the bog. I moved it experimentally, and felt myself slide further still, the mud cold and heavy against my hips. This will not do, I said severely. I still held half the pole in my hand, and with an Herculean effort, I plunged it once more into the ground, taking care to bury it deep enough this time. I wrapped both hands around the small portion that remained above ground, pulling myself forwards, one painful inch at a time. Time moved with the slow thickness of treacle, but it was most likely only a few minutes before I was able to feel solid ground beneath my hips. Danger still lurked, I reminded myself. One false move, and I should slip back into the welcoming embrace of the bog mud. With infinite care, I pulled the makeshift stake free and drove it home again, stretching out my arms to secure it as far into safety as I could. I inched forwards again, this time hearing my feet come free with a decidedly loud sucking sound. A person with little experience of such places might have attempted to stand at this point, but I knew better. I pulled my legs to my chest and rolled, over and again, until I was on trustworthy ground. Then I sat, breathing hard and cursing myself for a fool. As I had explained to Effie Hathaway on our first day, I knew well enough how to care for myself in such situations. And yet, the first rule my guide had impressed upon me was the importance of avoiding such peril in the first place. "The easiest quicksand to get out of, Miss Veronica," he had said with an emphatic gesture, "is the one into which one never gets." I had always enjoyed his unique turns of phrase, and that was one that had remained with me always. At least until now, I reminded myself with some bitterness. It has been my experience that when one is accosted by a lowness of spirits due to some failing in one's character, it becomes a habit to seek out and prod any other failing. Self-loathing is a habit, and one I could not afford to indulge. I doubt I should have castigated myself so thoroughly on my mistakes in the bog had I not already felt akin to a worm in light of my association with Harry Spenlove. I was not entirely certain which I deplored more, the fact that I had married him in the first place, the knowledge that I had not been completely truthful with Stoker, the opportunity I had not seized to tell Stoker the full story the previous night, or the sordid little scene in which I had just engaged with my erstwhile husband. I was tempted to keep his secret, not solely to protect Stoker, I reflected as I lay in the moor grass. My exertions had stripped me of my emotions and pretenses, leaving me to face the unwelcome truth. I was inclined to protect Harry because I believed there was a grain of truth to his story. It might well have been no more significant than a speck of sand in an hourglass, but it was enough to cause me considerable consternation. With a muted roar, I rolled onto my stomach and thrust myself onto my knees and then to a standing position. I was covered in mud and would no doubt be sore when the agitation of the experience had worn off. I required a hot bath and clean clothes. My attempt at adventure had come to an ignominious end.